This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Take a look at this. Dr. Martin Brenner. Who? Brenner. He runs Hawkins' lab.
Okay.
You don't find that interesting?
Not really. He was involved in some hippie crap back in the day, so what?
No, this isn't hippie crap. This is CIA-sanctioned research.
Barb wakes up in a creepy, deserted version of Steve's pool and is chased and tormented by the Demigorgon. Her status remains unclear throughout the episode, though her friend Nancy makes attempts to find her.
Joyce attempts communication with Will by stringing up an ever-elaborate system of Christmas lights throughout her house, finally setting on a Ouija board-style system where her supposed Will has one message for her. Run.
Hopper visits Hawkins' lab where he is given the runaround and begins to piece together the facility's dark history of human experimentation and wonders if Will didn't get caught up at the wrong place and the wrong time.
Jonathan is humiliated as Stephen and Nancy confront him about his late-night photo session involving them, but Nancy is drawn to the pictures showing a lonely Barb out by Steve's pool.
Finally, the boys gear up for Operation Mirkwood, where Elle has agreed to help them find Will, only to be led back to Will's house. There, the boys see a bunch of emergency vehicles fly by and ride their bikes to the local quarry, where a body, apparently Will's, is being dragged out of the water.
Welcome to Dungeons & Demigorgons, the officially unofficial podcast for Stranger Things on Netflix. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we just watched Chapter 3, titled Holly Jolly. Holly is not so jolly anymore, after seeing that horror show. that would creep me out if I were a little kid and I saw something coming through the walls.
Oh, was her name, the little girl's name is Holly?
Yeah. That's, I guess, what they hinge the entire name of the episode on, which is just like a minor point.
Yeah, okay.
But, all right. Maybe they tried to get a little too clever with that name.
It's also a Christmas title. A
it is, yeah. Oh,
okay. I wasn't sure if you knew that.
Sure.
You're not fluting Christmas.
I've never heard the Holly Jolly Christmas song.
What did you think of this episode?
I thought it was another really good episode. Mm-hmm. I thought it was... the whole episode moves surprisingly briskly, just like the first two. I mean, I kept getting caught up. I think it was interesting to me how sort of the boys almost take a back seat in this episode to everything
right.
else, or at least like in my attention, I guess. The least interesting thing that was happening this episode was the boys going on this quest, Operation Mirkwood. Everything else around it was kind of more interesting, which is kind of the opposite, I think, in my opinion, of what's been happening the first two episodes.
Yeah, I agree with you, but I also think there was a couple of things that there are departures for Stranger Things thus far. Like I noticed in our recap that we do, there was a lot. The word apparent and apparently was used like a billion times because... Whereas I feel like we as the viewers have seen a pretty straightforward account. Like, we don't know what's going on in the context for things, but we know, like, oh, this is happening, and it's like... Whereas they, on many, many occasions this episode, we are left unclear about where people are at, what they're doing, if they're really thing, if who found this body, what is this body. And it kind of feels like some of this stuff is to generate drama within the characters. They also backed off on some what I would think would be natural drama around some characters. And I feel like it's probably because they need to get these people to hit certain beats. I don't know. I felt like this was kind of, I don't know if using the word writerly is the right way to describe it. But what I'm trying to say is that for the very first time, I could hear a little bit of click and clacking of people like debating and trying to rewrite scenes. And it's not saying it's a bad episode. I'm just saying that like this felt very much a connecting from one part of the story to the other.
There was one moment where I think we're talking about the same moment with the camera breaking scene where I felt like maybe the characters' reactions weren't entirely influenced by what was happening.
Yeah, like this. Like,
it was more like we have an established relationship of ours in their head.
Yeah.
In like the writers' heads, right?
Right.
And they want to just keep pushing that agenda as opposed to like the natural reaction that I think... I mean, maybe we should just talk about that scene.
Yeah, let's do it.
I think Nancy would have been a little more off-put by the creeper angle of these photos, and she seemed more concerned in that moment on screen about Beth. Barb.
I think your average high school girl would be fucking mortified and livid of this guy taking these creeper photos, and that's without everything they've said in this episode about how on edge Nancy has been about this, because this is not something that Nancy typically does, and she's very afraid that people will think differently of her and everyone will be watching her, and now she's confronted with someone taking fucking pictures and this thing is going going viral in the high school, and she's like just got makes thoughtful expressions about, like, I get,
you know,
there
what?
Is an element of that, but they told story of Nancy going this other way, and that there was almost none of that. And I feel like it's because they're going to eventually need Jonathan to be a sympathetic character, and they give no explanation of why.
Well, I think I might have just changed my own mind.
Thinking about this.
So you have to look at, like, I guess. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense in retrospect. They're both kind of on the same mission at that point, right? She's like super worried about Barb. She knows that Jonathan is super worried about Will, and she kind of connects the dots and said, "Okay, maybe he was really just looking for Will." Because he says that in the scene.
I guess, but on the other hand,
maybe she believes him.
Maybe she does. I don't think she should, because I don't think those pictures were out finding Will.
Those pictures, yeah, didn't say, "Hey, I'm looking for my brother." They said, I'm a creeper.
Like, that might, like, it would not surprise me that there is a weird looking fucking claw or hand in those pictures of Barb. Like, that there is something that eventually breaks open this the Demigorgon side of this case. However, I do not believe that was Will's purpose of taking these pictures. I honestly don't know why the hell. I hope they address it, because otherwise, it is it's some really creepy shit, Jonathan.
Yeah.
Should have been doing.
Yeah. Like we said last time, the only purpose for those pictures would be blackmail or, I guess, wank bank stuff. But
some really sad wank. I mean, this is pre-internet.
Yeah.
I get it.
You're get living it where with you your single mom. It.
She's not going to have Playboys lying around.
No. Your dad does. Come on.
Yeah.
Go to your fucking dad's house. He's got the Playboys.
Your fucking dad's probably got some weird shit on Super 8, too, judging by what I can see from him. But that opening scene of Nancy and Steve making out juxtaposed with Barb fighting for life in a pool, I think was a bit much. I felt
Steve
is
the Demogorgon to Nancy,
I
right?
guess, because they kept showing like Barb's clenched fist around the swimming pools, you know, that like those chrome pipes they got around the ladders of every pool ever.
Yep.
I don't know why that's the aesthetic. Why is bare chrome pipe? Like,
I don't know. I mean, I guess you're not going to put like a wooden banister.
Not a wooden,
into the
but
pool.
Like you could do like some kind of, I don't know, like instead of being chrome, it could be like white or blue or you know,
acrylic, maybe transparent.
Yeah, you could make something look like a fucking seashell or something. I don't know, like just like, go with the fucking theme. It's why is this industrial brutal architecture the default of swimming pools? Anyway.
Yeah, they really
with,
made
with
him
that
out.
With her, you know, like clinching Steve's arm as he's sexing her up. I thought that was a little bit eye rolly.
Okay.
And then you know that's the thing. Like, I don't know if that's because there's a little bit of weakness of the connecting episodes here, or because they had this like statement that like you can show this much of the Demigorgon and not where, and like it's got to be ambiguous, so like the director's trying to do something creative with it. I don't know, but it didn't work for me.
Yeah, because I guess we don't know the fate of Barb at this point, right? She's not necessarily dead. She got dragged into the pool,
right?
And we heard some low grumbling.
Yeah. I mean, I would have thought she'd have been dead. Like,
Yeah.
It's funny because when she wakes up at the bottom of the pool and it's all very fucking Pan's Labyrinth down here. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was watching this, like, there was a whole bunch of things I was debating. Like, did the Demigorgons take you to, like, an alternate time? Like, are they here to invade Earth and it's kind of like a War of the Worlds and you're getting sucked through a time portal? Like, the nature of them and what they do is, and I thought they were suggesting that it's like, oh, well, this pool is like a Terminator 2 kind of thing where it's just been abandoned and this is after the war. And but then Barb looks like she's been fucked up, like she's been 10 rounds of the Demigorgon. When she wakes up, she's got a like blood on her face and there's mucus all over her, and like, why didn't the Demigorgon, like,
I'm trying to establish like rules for the Demigorgon. Can he can it like drag you into its world and then kill you? Can it kill you in the real world?
Yeah, because that's like what it seemed like happened to the scientist. But maybe he was in the Pan's Labyrinth version of the facility during that. That would explain why the elevator wasn't like shutting its door. Or maybe they feed off your fear.
It pulls Will in, so
it's one of those things where they can just like they don't want to kill you. They want to prolong your torture so they can feed off your psychic fear. Like, that shit's on the table too. So we just don't know enough.
Yep.
But in absence of concrete storytelling, they just go with, you know, like you said, Nancy is struggling with the Demigorgon, which is Steve, and Barb's struggling with the real thing. What do you want to do?
It's a pretty short cold open, though. A lot shorter than the last couple episodes.
Yeah.
It's like 30 seconds or something.
Yeah, it's short and sweet. What do you think about Nancy's relationship with her mom? Because her mom, like, at first, you know, I always think of her turn. I guess, what is her name? Kathy?
Her mom's name?
Yeah, Karen.
I don't know.
Okay. So I look at Karen in terms of like my relationship growing up in the 80s with my mother and like my father, and like there was this thing where like you just understood that if you told your parents the truth about certain things, it's just a bad idea. It's fucked up.
Yeah.
Because you're gonna get smacked or whatever. Mm-hmm. It seems like Karen is like bending over backwards to tell both of her children, like, look, you can tell me dangerous, unsafe things because I'm worried about your safety. And none of her kids take her up on that.
No.
Like, Nancy just doubles down on the lying and bullshit. Will just, I don't, you know, he's not necessarily, well, I guess he's lying too. I don't get it. I don't get that dynamic.
Okay.
Why do these children unsafe talking to their parents?
Honestly, that seems like the default dynamic to me. Like, nobody talks, no kids talk to their parents about this shit, right?
That's sad. I mean, I'm coming up. I've got a proto teenager. I'm working on myself, and I'm like, how do you avoid that?
Good luck.
I don't know. It's like,
that feels more like the default mode, in my mind. At least, like, with my cultural osmosis, that's the feeling I've always had, is kids are very reluctant to talk to their parents about anything.
Right.
But I thought that was a great, like, subtle's not the right word, because, you know, there's a lot of dialogue there that just says, hey, talk to me. No, Mom, I'm not going to talk to you. Uh-huh. But there's some subtle performances, I think, especially from the woman playing Karen, whose name I don't know. She's really great here because she's you know, extending that branch to her child to say, mm-hmm. hey, please, like, if you have any problems, come talk to me and we will sort them out. You won't be in trouble. Mm-hmm. But her daughter is just not taking her up on it. And I thought it was a really excellent moment. You can see, like, she's starting to well up during that scene. And it's just like, I don't know, with a very small moment there, they paint a really nice picture of Karen.
Yeah. And it's like, because it seems like, by all accounts, Nancy's been the perfect child. So, like,
sure, yeah.
You know, what do you do when your kid, like, that's something I ponder, is like, what do you do if you got a kid that's been a basically good kid and suddenly their grades start slipping? And, like, you know, something's going on. What the hell is it?
And they're hanging out with the Breakfast Club.
Yeah, and they're hanging out with the human Demigorgon Steve.
Right.
And, like, that's not good. But what do you do? What do you do about it? Because, like, you just, like, fucking jump their shit and start the Gestapo tactics and drive them further away? Or do you wait until they're, you know, fucking in real danger and hopefully they'll make the right call? Like,
I guess you wait.
Being
until
a parent's scary, man.
Their best friend gets sucked into the pool by a Demogorgon, and then they come to you. Like, this problem solves itself.
The other thing I really liked about this episode was, and one of the more interesting conceits they have in this season of Stranger Things, is the character of Joyce, who is your stereotypical nut job, but she's right. It's like the it's like the Randy Quaid character from Independence Day.
Uh-huh.
And well, I mean, so you're saying is she? And I guess that's a good question, because she might not be right that this is Will, but she is right that something is communicating with her through these lights. And is it Will? Yeah. Is it the Demogorgon? I assume that it's Will, because he says things that are agreeing with L, and I think we're supposed to synthesize these plots. That L says that he's right here hiding.
Yeah.
The boys say no fucking way. The Ouija board Christmas lights say that he's there hiding, and also the run, and then the Demogorgon tries to attack her. So I think it's Will.
I think so.
And I like that. I always like that's like, you know, the kind of thing like everyone thinks this person's full of shit. Mm-hmm. But and it reminds me, like I read this book somewhere. It's like, you know, having people that were off was not a problem in past times, because they would just become the shaman or okay. the... You know, they'd be the ones that are, like, saying that doom and gloom or happy times are coming, whatever. And, like, that's the role that they would play. But now, like, you've got these crazy people, and they're just, like, in a secular world, they're just a nuisance. They have no place in society, and that's kind of, like, an interesting way to look at Joyce. Did She, in older, simpler times, people would have listened to her, and we could have band together and defeated the Demogorgon. But now we want things like evidence and proof. And
or at the very least, she doesn't, I guess, necessarily have to go to her boss and ask for handouts, you know?
Oh, that's...
Like, the scene where she's in there buying Christmas lights. It's a good thing that this takes place very close to Christmas, because if not...
Yeah.
There's no way she gets those lights.
Well, right. I mean, not only that, but, like, they wouldn't be selling them.
Yeah,
like,
that too. Yeah,
like that's
you can't just Amazon up this shit,
right? And the idea that she is splurging this Christmas light money with the money he advanced her—it's
awesome.
The only thing funnier is if she would, like, make eye contact with him from across the street as she's at her rival. She's at the Five and Dime across the street buying up their supply. Look, I'm spending your money, you know.
And a pack of Camels.
That's right. That's right. To just get a fucking case of Camels at this other place.
But yeah, I mean, the stuff with Nancy is also another example of this episode moving really briskly, I think. Like, they establish this communication with Will and then immediately pay it off by the Demogorgon coming out of her wall. And like, that's the thing. I guess the Demogorgon can pass freely through to the real world.
Yeah.
From whatever dimension it's in.
Yeah. Wood paneling and wallpaper offers just a momentary barrier
right.
to its crossing over.
But that's interesting, because I guess I assumed up to this point that goo on the wall was kind of like an exit or entry point between the two dimensions, and it doesn't seem like that's the case at all.
Because we also go into Hawking's research lab, and we see, like, the laboratory where this kind of all busted out in the first place. It's getting, like, taken over by these alien things that
are
coming through. Is
that what happened with the shed? Like, you think the shed is just spreading to the house at this point?
Might be.
Because we saw a little goo
out
there,
too. Like, are these goos, like, ways for them to weaken the barrier between their dimension and our dimension?
But what about the pool?
Their time and our time?
There was no goo at the pool.
That's true. There's no... Maybe chlorine just really all naturally weakens the bonds. Weakens lots of chemical bonds. It also weakens space-time bonds. I like that scene in the laboratory. I don't usually make the funny observations, but... There's a scene where Dr. Brenner is, like, standing in this heroic pose as they're slowly lowering a machine that's aligned right at his crotch level. Uh-huh. And he's wearing his full hazmat gear. It's like, you know, it's Dr. Hawking's testing the controversial, you know, hand job device.
Right.
Fifth dimensional hand jobs.
But is it worth it, Dr.
My God, he's so brave to stick your dick in there. But it's just like it's very, very triumphant when it all clicks together and they're bolting it down. What the hell?
Yeah.
What the hell is going on with that? With all this?
I don't know. They're either studying that stuff or trying to contain it. Or like, how much do they know about?
Well, another thing that's scary is that the way that we're introduced to that scene is Sheriff Hopper calling bullshit on their lies and obfuscations on the top side, and then you follow this vent that they were just hanging out by.
Yeah.
And you see this, like, spore-filled room. Like, what kind of contaminations are getting out into the Indiana atmosphere?
Yeah, nothing maybe good. That just landed in the pool.
Yeah. The chlorine just is the ideal medium for Demogorgon spore growth. And that's what happened to the Barb.
The other funny, I guess, observation that I had is that Dr. Brenner, I'm assuming, like, it's her real father. She's screaming Papa. She certainly thinks it's her father.
Yeah, that would be a twist. I'm not sure, but like that's the I started thinking like maybe he just has all the girls that he's raising him as dad just to keep him as a control mechanism. But maybe also this is actually his daughter,
right? Because one thing we haven't talked about yet is the stuff that Hopper uncovers about Dr. Brenner at the library, right? He finds like an article. They have the obligatory microfiche reading scene where they scroll him through. And they find out that he was doing some experiments under MK Ultra with like, psychedelics.
Which is the one reason why you can't just automatically dismiss all crackpot conspiracy theories, because every once in a while they're fucking true.
Right. The CIA is practicing with psychedelics, experimenting?
The CIA is actually trying to do mind control shit. That happened.
Right.
Illegally experimenting on people without their knowledge.
So it immediately... It connects it to L, right? The one person in this show that we know has mind powers. Mm-hmm. This is an observation I'm sure Dustin would make if he were privy to that information.
You want to know from how many yards away she could kill a yak with her mind bullets.
I don't know how much we can connect those two, but I think there's certainly something there.
Yeah.
But she throws... So she's... They want her to kill this cat in the flashback that we get, right?
And to be fair, they got the biggest asshole cat they could find. Like,
yeah,
this
it's a nasty cat
is hissing and for no fucking good reason. Just, you know, the kind of cat that you wish you could just smother psychically.
She refuses to kill Nasty Cat, and they drag her off to her room. They send her to her room, essentially, and she freaks out. She throws a tantrum, and she kills a couple of guards. And then, I guess, Dr. Brenner, in a moment of bad parenting, decides, yep, that's enough punishment for you. Like, you can get out of your punishment by throwing a tantrum.
Yeah.
What kind of lesson is he teaching?
And what is it like?
Girl?
I get that solitary confinement is a cruel and unusual punishment.
Right.
But like,
I'm obviously joking here. But...
No. Well, but I'm kind of with you. Like, what is goes on? Like, what are their ways of making her comply? Like the carrot and stick. Like it's.
Yeah.
I honestly like the way that it's left unsaid, because, you know, your mind can come up with all kinds of, like, crazy-ass things. I've noticed, like, the orderlies, as they're leading away, they're, like, armed with these, like, fucking blackjacks. Like, you know, it's like, imagine hitting a little girl in the face with one of those.
I thought they were, like, horrifying. Stun guns or something, was my assumption.
Oh. Well, I mean, they might have had that, too, but I'm saying, like, one had on the left hip, one on the right, these, like, leather-weighted, like, baton kind of things.
Wow.
Very similar to that guy in season 3 of Fargo had, you know, the Yuri guy.
Yep.
So
my mind immediately thinks, like, where is he taking her? Like, I really like the flashback here. It does a lot for the character of Elle and for us to understand her a little bit better. But I don't think we've seen the last of that scene, right? That's a continuation of the flashback we saw before.
Yeah, we have even more when Will locked her in a closet, or sorry, Mike locked her in a closet. Yeah.
So where is he taking her? Like, I guess why
back
would he reward
cat.
This behavior, right? Like, yeah, is he going to sit her back in front of the cat? Is he training her to do this stuff?
Yeah, like you warmed up with the people, now go for the kitty. Like,
right.
It's very disturbing.
Is this like a Weapon X sort of thing?
Like, it does feel like that, yeah. Like, they're trying to turn her into a weapon with like a bunch of different... emotional and coercive strategies.
Which, honestly, would go along with that idea that Dr. Brenner was involved with MK Ultra, right?
And it looked like he had a whole... if you saw snippets of the microfiche that they were reading, there's, like, allegations of child abuse. One mother says that someone stole her daughter. You see Dr. Brenner posing with all these young women, like, various teenage ages in hospital gowns. And it's like, man, if you... Like, it seems like there's already been enough that someone could have put the pieces together and, like, shut this shit down, but...
Yeah.
You know, but then again, there's also a whole bunch of headlines about the Hawking's lab stonewalling inquiries, and and they're trying to keep us one step ahead of the Russians, all right?
Right? You don't want us to lose that Cold War,
You want to make an omelet, you got to break a couple eggs. You want to stop the Russians, you got to traumatize a few little girls. What do you want?
Right.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hear the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
So this is on a lighter topic. I want to talk about the boys gearing up for Operation Mirkwood.
Yeah, this was the funniest scene, certainly.
Yeah. I love how they got, like, but not, like, everything was, like, legit because it's from Nam.
Right, which was, like, you know, it's not a few years ago at that point.
It's not military grade. It's not military. It's from Nam, so you know it's good.
Yeah.
Like, this binoculars came from Nam. And they got their wrist rocket. And then they compare that what Lucas has hauled with Dustin, and it's just all junk. You are going to be out in the forest for a couple hours. You are going to need that food. Like, you can't fucking eat wrist rockets.
He's not wrong, but totally within character,
right? Well. And then he says, we don't need weapons because we got L, which is kind of our operating theory from the last episode. Mm-hmm. Dares her to make the Millennium Falcon fly. Which doesn't exactly work, but then it does later. I thought it was cool that she ended up making the Falcon fly.
Yeah, I'm wondering about her powers too, I guess. Like,
yeah.
When she slams doors and stuff, she starts to bleed. When she kills people, she really starts to bleed out of all the
guys,
holes.
And she's got, yeah, all of her eye holes are leaking blood.
Right, and then she's just sort of levitating stuff for fun while the kids are out, while the boys are out.
Doesn't seem like that made her bleed.
No, and if it did, why would she do that? That's not fun.
I don't know.
So, I wonder if there's, like, a certain amount of emotional distress that combines with the power to make her bleed, how much power she has to manifest in order for it to affect her that way.
I'm glad they showed her killing the two guys, and, like, because till then she has done she demonstrated nothing that the average little girl's right arm could not do. Like, she crumples a Coke can, she slams a door, she makes a plastic toy levitate. Yeah. Like, okay.
But Von Dustin, with her mind.
Right. This is like she can cyclically move things. The bummer is she can only cyclically move things as much as an 11-year-old girl could do.
Yeah, that'd be a bummer.
Like, she's going to do okay with a milk jug, but, you know, a 5-gallon bucket of water is going to be a real problem for her. But no, she can kill dudes. No probs. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, if you define both nose holes and ear holes bleeding as no probs, you can do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. She's clearly dangerous, but what are the limits of her power? And like, also, I thought it was interesting when they showed her kill the two guys. Her face was like strangely modeled, and I wasn't sure if they're suggesting that like she's burst a bunch of capillaries or. You know, now we got these demigorgons. We're getting better looks at them. Like, is she some kind of fucking half-breed technology? Like, she's got demigorgon DNA?
I think they're encouraging that speculation with her, like, escaping at the same time as the demigorgon,
right?
Yeah, like,
there is a connection there. Thematic, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Biological, perhaps.
Who knows?
It's going into my crazy conspiracy theory file for later use.
I couldn't help but notice that. So I had never really taken a good look at Nancy's room before, but when Elle's kind of wandering the house and goes into Nancy's room, I couldn't help but notice they didn't go nearly as hard on the 80s girl references as they did the 80s boy references. Hmm. There's like a single poster of Tom Cruise up on the wall, and that's it.
I intuited it's because Nancy is that kind of 80s girl. She's an adult. She wants to she wants to be an adult very, very bad.
But only to the level where she's not totally immune to Tom Cruise's charms.
Yeah, sure. Who isn't?
Right.
Who isn't? 30 years later, the man's still in incredible shape.
Okay, I could see maybe that's what they were going for.
And it is weird because that scene was supposed to be 11 finding out what it means to be the average American girl, which Nancy is not.
No.
And, you know, it seems like that speaks to 11 because she's been, you know, brutalized and her head shaved in hospital gowns her whole life. Like, Nancy is very, you know, among her other scholastic and maturity gifts, she's also very, you know, soft and frilly and lacy and ribbony.
Mm-hmm.
And what's that, is that going to be something that 11 is drawn to or repulsed by? Is she going to be a Tom girl or Tom boy?
I don't know.
Is a tomboy? The girl's a tomboy. What the fuck does that mean?
I have no idea what the etymology.
Where did the etymology of tomboys come from?
I don't know.
Like, wouldn't it be a tom girl? Like,
I would think so, yeah.
Tom cat's a boy cat. Tom boy's like, that's just like a fucking boy.
Okay.
It's so weird. Like, tom girl I could get. I don't know.
Are you saying language is a strange and evolving thing?
Oh, and its intersection with societal expectations as it pertains to gender normatives. Yeah, sure, it's fucking weird. It's fucking really. It's
saying
it's
complex.
It's one of the stranger things we have.
Yeah.
What else we want to talk about?
I want to talk about the ending. So they pull what I can only describe as Marty McFly out of the quarry because. God damn it! It is exactly his outfit.
Did he pull that life vest off some dead Chinese? That's what I want to know. The dead China man. What did they say? Something racist.
Big Lebowski? Is that the?
No, that was reference? Because when Marty walks in with his like fucking vest, his sleeveless.
Oh right, in number two, yeah, in the future.
No, it was in the past. They're like, are you in the Coast Guard or did you? Oh, you're right. You're right. They asked him that in the third one.
In the third, Jesus.
Because it's the Wild West.
Yeah,
making
the Wild
fun
West.
Of Chinese. Okay.
Yep.
So it was the Coast Guard.
We were both
wrong.
But we.
I think in all three movies, they make some kind of Monopoly guy wry observation about his dress.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. So, they pull Marty McFly out of the quarry, and Mike immediately thinks it's Will, and I think all of them. Think it's Will all the boys.
And 11, I think on the look on her face is that she's as shocked as anybody to find out that it is.
But they never showed the face of the body, which to me says they want us to question, is this actually Will?
Yeah.
Because we've just had what we think is Will communicating with Joyce.
Yes.
We didn't get a shot. If they wanted to show us that this was Will, they could prove it by showing his face.
Yes.
Done. Game overs. But I don't know why they the only explanation I can come up with for not showing his face is they want us to question it.
Yeah,
and this might not in fact be Will.
That's why I'm saying this episode's not quite as tight as the others, because I feel like, you know, we always said that like in Breaking Bad, like there's a time or two where for whatever reason Walter White like pulls the privacy curtain in front of the audience and we can't see what he's doing, which stands out because usually he's operating in broad daylight and we're kind of like trying to puzzle out what the hell he's doing,
right?
But like to actually, you know, to show things that happened that they didn't show us, and I feel like this episode dabbled heavily in, if we actually show the audience what we're doing here, it's going to kind of fall apart and not have the effect. So we have to be a little bit trickier and more underhanded.
Okay when they do that with the horror aspects, like when they don't show the Demogorgon. Right?
Oh yeah,
or they tease those sorts of things.
Right,
that's just part of the genre. But
yeah.
Yeah, to do it with something like this is
the
a little strange.
The plot mechanics are like you've got this like this at this point. This boy's body is a MacGuffin because it's only interesting in the fact that we don't – like if it's Will, then we got – I mean I guess what I'm trying to say is that it seems like a horseshit way to build suspense because it's not real suspense. Uh-huh. This suspense could be dispelled by Hopper going forward and like flinging a sheet aside,
yeah,
which as the fucking cop who has jurisdiction over this, he would be well within his rights to do. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, they don't want to clear that up.
Yeah, what if they come back and – it just is Will. Like, they show us his body. He's dead. Because is he dead? Is he in another dimension? Does his physical form go with him? I don't know what's happening with Will.
So I want to confess something.
Okay.
I honestly don't know where they're going with this. This is like, I don't remember them finding Will's body at a quarry. So
same
I feel
here.
Like I can yeah. I can speculate freely because if they if it turns out that this is Will's body, I could believe that they cloned it. From hair that they that the Modines found, the Matthew Modine found in Joyce's trailer, you know,
okay.
Or her house. Like it could be a different timeline. Will it could be a boy? Like the other thing is we didn't see his face. It could be because the face was like eaten off by fish or something. So it could be another kid that they murdered to stand in for Will. Like there's a lot of supernatural mechanics and scientific wooby dooby stuff going on here that it could be Will and not Will, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Or especially if it's you. Like I'm also not like if this is like a space time kind of jump rather than like your conventional dark dimension kind of thing, and then maybe it's like Will from 6 weeks ago. I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really open on that question as well. I just don't know what to think. The show clearly wants me to just go with the boy's notion here that it's Will, but my TV watching brain has a hard time just following that trail. So I guess we'll see, you know, the next episode is there to be watched. So I guess we should probably get to it.
I really like the strong ending montage with the Peter Gabriel's Heroes.
Oh yeah,
I thought
with
that
the,
was
both
really,
the hugging pairs.
Yeah, I thought that was really good, and it was well put together to have this kind of like again. I'm not sure I'm on board with the mystery here, but the driving sense of urgency and desperation.
Well, I think it
and kind of bittersweetness. It was pretty good.
I think it once again pairs, you know, Jonathan and the other characters, I guess, like the quest that he's on with the quest that they're on. I mean, Mike obviously has always been paired with him.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we talked about, like, the camera scene, that's kind of where my mind goes. Like, these kids all understand each other because they're on the same mission to find their friend.
Right.
And I feel like that's a good thing. Like, if you want to bring Nancy into this mission somehow, make her more sympathetic to it.
Yeah,
you have to give her a reason to care because she didn't at the beginning.
She's got
to
have skin in the game.
Yeah,
and now she does. She's got the quest for Barb.
Yeah,
I really like. I continue to like Winona Ryder. It's her kind of wild-eyed, obsessive performance with Joyce, and she's the type of character that normally drives me nuts. But it helps that she's correct. She's dead on in her observations.
And we know that.
And we know that because the only other way to make a character like this work is to have them be kind of funny, like the Randy Quaid pitiful.
Oh, right.
You know, crop duster in Independence Day. But having her just be right. And she's caught constantly in situations where she just looks like she's a fucking lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that. Also, like, there's something interesting they're doing with Eleven, like her trying to figure out the world by the interaction she has with her boys, or with the boys, and observationally, like she didn't understand loyalty and friendship, and now she's got a handle on that, and she wants to know why these boys are hurting you at school.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, also why is Mike kind of, like, brushing that shit off? Like, if that's, like, and the answer is that for whatever reason, in this school, it's acceptable to run schools like prisons.
Yeah.
That's it's an institution like every other fucking one. But I really like that she's doing a lot of this amazing amount, like, Molly Bobby Brown, right?
Millie Bobby Brown.
Yeah, like a Millie, like it's an explosion of 80s artists. One lip syncer, and or two lip syncers,
which
and,
is funny because she doesn't talk much. So.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Pretty good.
But yeah, she's doing a lot of great work of just like this pantomime of just, you know, she's got these big expressive eyes and they're just taking in everything all around her. It's like watching a baby learn.
Uh-huh.
And she's doing a hell of a job with it. That's all. That's all the stuff I got to talk about this episode.
Okay.
Thanks for listening to our Season 1 coverage of Stranger Things. If you like what you hear and want more, check out all of our television, movie, and pop culture content on baldmove.com. If you'd like to help support our podcast and get a ton of bonus content and features, check out club.baldmove.com. We'll also be taking feedback during our upcoming Season 1 wrap-up podcast, so send that in to strangerthings@baldmove.com. You can also discuss this with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.